Pit 37, side one. June 22nd, 1977, House Committee on Revenue and School Finance.
To convene the meeting, I'd like just to run a concept by the committee on 3257, just have it outlined for you. That, you recall, was the small woodlot bill that we deferred action on. And what I'd like to do is just have outlined for us some proposed amendments. We don't have anything in writing at this point, but we have the folks in the Small Woodlot Association here. And if you folks want to join us, just briefly, what I thought we'd do is just spend 5 minutes or so just outlining what they're talking about, and then that we would come back and go to work on it tomorrow. I'm confident we can get a bill out in fairly short order, and I'll explain here what amendments we've discussed. And on Friday, if there's no objection from the committee, I would like to finish our treatment, hopefully forever, of timber tax by just raising the Eastern Oregon land value question that we couldn't resolve in the context of the big bill, but there are folks from particularly Eastern Oregon who would like to come and just share their analysis of how we might be able to adopt the formula in the event that it survives the minority report challenge tomorrow, how it could be applied to Eastern Oregon. If there's no objection, on Friday morning, is that, or can I be here tomorrow?
No,
it seemed to me that that's what I talked to John. Okay. Very briefly, who, George or Clyde?
George, do it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is George Babbitts. I represent the Northwest Christmas Tree Association. The others want it. Well, I'm also a member of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. In the original discussion of 3257, which was about 2 weeks ago on a Wednesday night or Thursday night, there was, I believe, the discussion of a major discussion which pertained to Section 3, which had to do with setting values and then freezing those values at 50% of the calculated value for site class land values. And that was described as an unsatisfactory approach to the problem. And I think we agree that it is an unsatisfactory approach to the problem. 3257 changes the small woman, amends the small woman law in four or five significant areas. First of all, it increases the acreage to 2,000 from 1,000 and sets a minimum acreage of 10 acres to be eligible under the small tract option law. There is a grandfather clause for those people who may have less than 10 acres, they can still stay under it. There is a management plan incorporated in the process based on the elements of the Forest Practices Act. The law would be changed to provide for a notification procedure similar to that which is in 3274, 60-day notification procedure. It would provide for an appeals procedure which is not in the current law, which is now being challenged in the courts, I believe. And it would establish Christmas trees as an agricultural crop not subject to a harvest tax. The consensus of the small woman owners and Christmas tree growers is that Section 3, which would freeze the values, the site class values at 50%, as described in the bill, should be deleted, and that the existing law will take care of the situation, in that the existing law says that all the costs of growing the timber are supposed to be taken into account. And there's discussion, and has been, with the Department of Forestry that perhaps all those costs aren't being taken into account. That, in brief, is what 3257 would do to the existing small tract auction law. There's other language in here which makes it compatible with other statutes in the ORS.
Rationalizing the acreage requirements, putting a rational minimum and perhaps increasing the maximum, and trying to go at the problem of valuation in terms of what factors are, in terms of the formula, rather than freezing the values, seems to me to be far superior. And it seems to me that just in terms of the way it's been described, we can get a bill that is non-controversial enough that we can actually get the thing through in relatively short order. And if it meets with the committee's approval, what we'll start off tomorrow with just going over the bill, and there's one other amendment we might consider, we might be able to do in 3257, and that's to we might discuss the potential of converting from this to the provisions of the yield tax after harvest, discuss the issue of convertibility, and see what, if anything, we might want to add to make to encourage it. If we allowed such conversion as an alternative to other changes, I would like to not as an alternative to other changes, but along with it, the issue of conversion, so we move towards the point of having just one law, I think has some merit. But we will have the notebooks, the issues prepared, and you folks, some of you will be able to join us tomorrow. Is that fair? Mm-hmm. Greg, is there anything you wanted to add that people?
On the notification, apparently you can be disqualified if you don't file within 60 days after a change of ownership, but may be by reason of death. And this is one of the changes they proposed, but they don't propose a retroactive change. And there have been a number of people that have been caught in that bind, and really it's nothing like tax avoidance at all.
I'm sorry for not mentioning it. I feel very strongly that we ought to make it retroactive, so we don't pot people who have not changed the use, where it's just been by a debt that land is. Title of land is passed by death in the family, and I think that it's unduly harsh. And if there's no objection,
that's a good, Mr. Chairman. Like that's excellent, because there are two or three real sad cases right now, and just no redress for those.
So we'll come prepared tomorrow to try and deal with it in those terms. Could we have Richard and Greg? Are they? We have a quorum. Let's maybe ask, not Richard and Greg, but Terry and Richard perhaps join us. I would also like, if you could see, if our friends could be called, see who's coming. I would like to look at, from the committee, see if people are on their way.
All right.
We've talked about some possible amendments to 543, Mary. Do you?
What's 543?
543 is the rate base.
Serial operating serial levy.
Oh. Well, if we limit it to 3 years, I think somebody mentioned it to me.
Yes.
I'll help vote it out.
Okay.
I'm not really enthusiastic.
If there's no objection, I would like to we're going to switch subjects. Okay. Thank you very much for joining.
We're about to have a
good
game up here.
That's okay. There's a lot
of, the committee,
usually a lot of crap that, well.
No, don't say that.
Fine. We'll just.
Thank you very much.
Which will be.
Okay. 543, you recall, was the serial rate base.
Do we have a copy of the bill?
Yes.
We.
Thank you. We've already amended, thank you, the provisions to.
Mr. Chairman, would you like a motion to take it off the table?
Is there an objection to taking it off the table? Ordered. That's right, what's table? We've already amended it to be 10 years. We had 5 years for operating and 10 years for capital construction. Is there a motion to, was there a motion on the 3 year limiting for, we'd have to draft an amendment to limit it to, for operating purposes, for 3 years.
So moved.
To make that differentiation. The language isn't in there now, it's just all limited to 10.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Monroe moves that we amend Senate Bill 543 to provide a limitation of 3 years on for operational purposes. You've heard the motion. Is there any objection? Is there a motion on the amended bill? A discussion? Representative Achilles moves amended House Bill 543 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Can I just ask what's happening to 3209 over on the other side and the other six general bills?
3209 has been subject to some interesting changes. I think their people are still. I don't think we're going to be able to concur with it in terms of, not so much of the split between equalization and the flat grant, but there are changes that have been made that keep intact the entire IED equalization structure in the event that the legislature passes basic school support and calls it less than 40%. We can call it whatever we want. There's no requirement on how it's computed, and that we attach that label to it. So we could, in effect, approve 50% of the actual costs for operating schools, and call it 35%, and it would trigger the old distribution system. The IEDs continue. There's a paper transaction of levying the property tax. There was a kicker that was added the last hour in committee by the IED that says that in the event that there are new programs mandated by the federal or state government for dealing with handicapped children, that these can be financed as resolution expenses out of that existing IED base, without a vote of the people.
Is that the way this bill's coming out of committee, or is that
yes,
the way it's out?
It's out. It's out, and it's going to be voted on in the next couple of days.
Conference committee.
All right, thanks. Yeah.
The bill itself, in terms of the major issue, We're having a parallel run generated that shows their 31% basic grant, the 30% basic grant, and what people are getting now. So for comparison purposes, people will be able to see. I don't think that's a major hang-up. at some of these other things that have been tagged on. But I don't think that, in any event, that there'll be any problem, Mary. The only reason I mention these two factors is I think that it's the consensus of most people who've taken a look at it that they probably would not feel comfortable concurring with 3209's present form. So we'll be able to pick up and add any language, I think, that might be necessary if people feel something needs to conform 543 or something else to 3209.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get at a total of what's needed here in view of the...
That's going to be my recommendation at this point, is that we not concur.
I really don't see any conflict.
No, I don't either. I'm just trying to find out what kind of tool we come out with as tools.
Well, frankly, I'm not prepared to say there isn't any conflict with anything until I see the bill in its final form. I don't know what kickers have been added. The problems, well, I'd like to discuss that with the committee at a later point, but the problems
right.
I see with 3209 just mechanically are going to just be mind-boggling.
Did they put in a statewide property tax in 3209?
No, not yet.
No.
That's Vern's proposal for the conference committee. The is Senate Bill 43 has amended the flow of the DUPAS recommendation. There's no...
Was the 10 to 3 year
yes.
change the only,
yes.
the only change?
Yes.
It's 3 years for operating, 10 remains for capital. I've got to build a new school. You're not going to be limited to 3 years.
Oh, it wouldn't put this on for serial levies, would it? I mean, for capital concerns. This is for capital concerns.
It can be used for either. There would be an option. They would have a maximum of 10 years for capital construction, 3 years for operating purposes.
What do they have now for capital construction on
serial levy? You have a serial levy that can extend...
Is there a limitation on the number of years?
I don't think so.
Under present Chapter 280, a serial levy can only be levied for 10 years and the money has to be spent in 12 years.
Okay. So the difference on that will be that you're not going to be front end loading it, and it'll be pegged. Right? That's still there.
So capital construction would be subject to the same requirements as current law. 3 years for operation. You've heard the motion.
If the 10-year capital levy wouldn't go on the rate base, it would remain as it is.
This bill would give them the option to go at the rate base for capital construction purposes of going. This gives the rate base for either purpose and sets a differential for the purpose. It would allow a 10-year rate base for capital construction purposes.
Would allow them to fund capital construction without the front end loading that they have to do with a regular serial levy. A serial levy has to be a set amount each year for the entire 10-year period, an equal amount, whereas the actual cost increases over the period because of inflation, and this would allow the figure to meet the actual needs, dollar needs, in each year.
Let me see if I have this.
It does. You lay out a 10-year levy, Rod. You for capital construction, you lay out your expenditures and get your bids in.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a fixed dollar amount.
At a fixed dollar amount,
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
really isn't necessary for capital construction.
Well, the testimony that we received was that under present serial levies for capital construction, they have to front end load. They have, the costs increase over the period. The carrying cost.
This is an alternate to bonding.
Well, it's an alternate way of funding bonding.
Pardon?
It's an alternate way of funding bonding, I would think.
It is an alternative to bonding.
It's an alternate to bonding.
Okay.
And you've don't need the same kind of growth in it that you need in that you might need in a in an operational levy. And I really am reluctant about that.
With our, it seems to me it is an additional tool that that if it's a specific project over a set period of time where it's going to be a phase 3 or 4 year project, I can see the logic to what you're saying, Ray, that it may not be necessary. By the same token, I can see for some capital construction purposes where it might well be of longer duration, and it may not be just a set of one or two bids that they have well in hand before they start. So I can see a local unit of government perhaps wanting to use this for capital construction purposes.
Well, it was the original intent of whoever behind those
years
just to address the operating levy question, or was it the whole?
Seems to me it was as I heard it described and as I discussed it with Senator Attia, and why I signed on it was that it gave that tool, subject to the same protections that they have now, and that there might be circumstances under which districts would want to utilize it. I don't want to prejudge
the ways they'd use it.
As long as there are protections in it that provide that people know what the costs are, that those estimates are required, and we have the protections on how they utilize it, it would be very inconsistent for me in terms of what I've tried to do in my support and trying to give more tools to units of local government that are not. And I think by circumscribing this very narrowly in terms of operating, I'm very reluctantly going to vote in favor of this amendment because I think it's unduly limiting the units of local government who have to get secure voter approval anyway. But it's an accommodation I'm willing to make because I think they need the tool available.
Is the amendment 3 years, Mr. Chairman?
The bill has been amended to 3 years for operating purposes.
3 years on capital. I'm persuaded by the brilliance of it.
So you could build a school and pass a levy that you wouldn't even know exactly how much it's going to raise.
We've gone through this before. They are required to make an estimate of what that rate would generate over time. Now, all of these are subject to some variations, but I think that... Representative Achilles has moved amended Senate Bill 543 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there... If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Achilles?
Aye.
Fumbles?
No.
Brunel?
Aye.
Klein? Mark?
Aye.
Leakey?
Aye.
Embley?
No.
Monroe?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Ordered. Thank you. If we could now turn very briefly, and Mr. Munn, perhaps you'd like to join us, I think, to 2104 in the little black folder. I want to just share with you what I was talking about yesterday. And let people think about it, and let people also hopefully discuss it with some of our colleagues to see if there's interest in this sort of approach. As you recall, we had discussed
House Bill 2059, as it will be voted on presumably today, we're talking about a reduction of 110, 170, perhaps $200 million or more over the next 10 years in state revenues. One of the points I had attempted to raise, and I would call to your attention the impact statement of amended House Bill 2104, subject to these proposed amendments. They have not actually been incorporated into it. If we want to phase in some tax relief for Oregonians, I wonder if you want to look at an escalating standard deduction credit and personal exemption credit as an alternative. If the feeling is we want to invest $100 or $200 million in property tax or in tax relief, the income tax is something that I feel strongly we ought to address in terms of the automatic increase that inflation provides. I think the real likely culprit for indexing is the federal income tax, where it's really necessary, where if we're not careful, in the very near future, everybody in the country is going to be paying the maximum rate without an act of Congress, just simply allowing people to be pulled up through the brackets.
What would be the effect of requiring indexing?
In what sense, Bob?
Now, what would be the effect of indexing those on the total amounts of revenue that would be raised in future years?
Well, we've looked. One of the reasons I asked Richard to join us, we looked during the interim at having some sort of adjustment in the personal income tax to reflect inflation, and the results were dramatic. Richard, you might outline what alternatives we looked at and what the impact was.
We looked at really taking the consumer price index in any one year and taking that times the taxable balance. So after you've taken your itemized deduction or standard deduction and personal exemption, and then reducing your taxable balance further by, if prices went up 5% one year by 5%, or 10% one year by 10%, I think the cost over the biennium was something like $70 million for that program.
If we were to have tied the rates more directly to inflation, to the cost of living, and made that permanent, it would have been something like a 40% reduction in the general fund over a 10-year period.
That recalculates it each year. You see, the proposal we looked at, just the, if it's 5% this year and 5% next year.
90% times.
No. The way the proposal was is if it's 5% the first year and 5% the second, you don't add the two together and make it 10% the second. You just take whatever the cost of living or the price index change was in one year and reduce your tax balance in that one year. You don't build in permanently the adjustment. And that was like $70 million. If you build permanently and build in the adjustment, you will, in a really relatively short period of time, reduce the take of the income tax in half.
Without further modifications.
Yes.
Who is, I know it's nice to benefit by having substantial increasing amounts of revenue available to operate state government. I mean, it makes it much more comfortable, and decisions, at least probably, are easier with that large surplus that we have. Who has been paying for that in terms of the particular economic stratum in the state of Oregon? Who gets hit most and racked most by not adjusting the income tax for?
you do that. No, you know, we're talking about...
No, I mean by segment.
We're talking about the folks from, about what, $10,000 to $30,000 that are...
Well, I don't know if you can distinguish. I don't know what you mean by who gets hit the most, because everybody is affected by inflation, and to the extent everybody's income is pulled up through inflation, they pay higher taxes. To the extent their income isn't pulled up by inflation, they face lower disposable income, and they're in the same relative position, being worse off in society. Now, the tax system didn't do it to them, but inflation still did it to them. So I don't know how you can distinguish between who's worse off and if you start looking at percentage amounts, who pays a higher percentage tax because of...
That's what I mean. Does it make it more proportional? Does it by...
Well, I presume in the long run, if we do nothing else to the tax system and let inflation continue to pull everybody up, and we hold the rates where they are, everybody will be at the top marginal tax rate, and so we'll all be equal.
Now,
what is that rate with the $5,000?
Well, if we're looking at the stated rate, it's 10%.
What is the real
rate? You reach that actual 10% is never. You approach it, but never reach it.
It seems to me that the people that are hit the hardest, to answer your question, Bob, are the people that are being moved from one percentage step into the next tax bracket in terms of the increased percentage of taxation, whereas those people that are already at the top tax bracket, although a slightly higher percentage of their income is taxed at the top bracket in comparison to at the lower brackets, that they're not hurt as bad in terms of their percentage increase of tax that they pay as a percent of their entire income,
which is about 10 to 20,000 for joint returns and about 5 to 15,000 on single returns.
I think that's where you'd have the seems to me you could identify those groups as having the largest increase, because they're 10 to 20,000 on joints and 5 to 15 on singles, because they're not only getting hit with, they're getting hit with the inflation, the artificial increase in income, plus they're getting hit with a higher marginal tax rate. That's ignoring federal change. But if we count federal change and that progressivity, it would extend the range. If you're just looking at states, it would be like 10 to 20 AGI and 5 to 15.
How many taxpayers are in
the tax? A majority of the tax filers, maybe 40% of the tax paid, 35 to 40% of tax paid, maybe a little less than that. But maybe 70 to 80% of people file returns. I realize that about 50% of our tax comes from over 20. That's about the break-even point.
I appreciate that that this might be a slight leap here in terms of what we've been discussing to this point, and I don't want to run it into the ground, but I do I did want to put it before the committee. I'd like if you could go over the impact statement, because I think this is the sort of thing we've got to be looking at when we're talking about other potential areas of revenue loss. And even if we're not talking about revenue loss, if we make it prospective, not make it apply to this biennium, but phase it in the future, set a mechanism whereby at least when we take the standard deduction and the personal exemption, that we have a credit that automatically increases at some reasonable amount to try and correct slightly for the impact of inflation. That concept, I think, has merit. I think, we ought to seriously consider passing it this session.
I would like to come back to this after you've had a chance to look at this and to look at the proposal. We wrote, it's written up in the interim committee report, isn't it, Richard?
Yes, we have some discussion on it.
Of the principle. If you could look at this impact statement, look at the interim committee, and then consider what alternative you folks would feel comfortable with. I would like to be able to do that tomorrow. Representative Grinnell, do you have a motion on HJR 14?
I'll move it to the floor with two fast recommendations, Mr. Chairman.
HJR 14, you want to briefly outline, Representative Grinnell, what the bill is?
I need to pass this bill, Mr. Chairman.
There, I put that one.
No, we haven't had a vote pulled up.
No,
right.
No.
This, as I recall, Representative Wolfer walked through the House last session. He appeared before the committee earlier, was interested in having dedicated mineral proceeds to the common school land.
Right. That was, right. His interest being that eventually he's convinced that there'll be certain mineral resources that will be developed within the state, and those ought to, there ought to be some accruement to the common school fund of use of state lands in developing those.
At least Molalla oil strike.
Indeed.
What it is, it provides for a constitutional amendment that be referred to the people. But essentially, it says the proceeds from any tax or excise levied on with respect to or measured by the extraction, production, storage, use, sale, distribution, or receipt of any mineral, after providing for the cost of the administration any refunds or credits authorized by law, and as used by this section, mineral includes any and all minerals, metallic or non-metallic, solid, liquid, gaseous, and he had in mind, of course, petroleum products.
Does not include geothermal?
I don't believe that would, because...
we talked about that was adopted last session.
Yeah. We've already done that, I think.
Yeah. And then that's when we got into the great discussion of whether geothermal was really a mineral or whether it was some other resource.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll on sending HGR 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Aye.
Bobbush.
Aye.
Grinnell.
Aye.
Klein. Mark.
Aye.
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 Yesterday, you recall, I raised the issue on 2754. We passed out the bill at that time. I indicated I'd talk to the chairman of the Judiciary Committee to see if he had any objection, or B, if he passed the bill. He said, A, he had no objection, B, he didn't want to see the bill, except if we sent it to the floor. Representative Whiting has been incredibly patient in light of my earlier promise that the committee would consider it, and I just simply fell between the cracks because it wasn't really a revenue bill, and I apologize to you and to her. That's why we brought it up yesterday. I'd like to know if there'd be a motion.
So moved.
This increase.
What number?
2754. It was just distributed. It deals with the same section of the statute we dealt with earlier in the session, in terms of now there's a differential between personal property and real property that's subject to probate. We passed legislation that conformed it to the higher figure. This just would lump them together at a still $5,000 figure, still $5,000 higher.
Did he have some scientific basis that allows you to arrive at $25,000
on that? It was higher.
It was higher.
Yeah. It was probably the same scientific basis we had for, well, never mind. The Representative that House Bill 2754 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Joyce?
Aye.
Walbush?
Aye.
Grinnell?
Aye.
Klein? Mark? Ricky?
Aye.
Van Vliet?
Aye.
Excuse me, what was the
motion?
2754 to the floor,
due
pass.
Good bill.
Hold
it down.
Gotta be a good bill.
Aye.
Monroe?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
aye.
Klein votes aye. Votes aye. Motion passes.
Yeah. Can I make an inquiry about a bill?
Representative Grinnell?
Yeah, House Bill 2102, which was the amount of money that is rebated back to the people, the cigarette distributors, is that what they are? Yeah, the distributor.
Yeah.
There were some amendments to that bill, and it has a subsequent ways and means. I don't see the amendments.
Would you like that discussed tomorrow, Representative Canoe?
Yeah, could that be discussed tomorrow, and maybe the adoption of those amendments, and maybe moving the bill then on to ways and means?
Let's bring that before the committee, and if time permits, we'll do it tomorrow or certainly Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If there's no objection, I would like to adjourn at this point. I think some of us have some material to prepare for today on the material on the transportation package. We will move with dispatch, I hope, tomorrow on this issue of the small woodlot, and I'd like to seriously consider the income tax. If people are, I would hope that you'd come tomorrow prepared to vote on indexing the income tax in some form, and I would greatly appreciate your carefully considering the proposed amendments to 2104 and looking at the interim committee report on the impact of inflation on the income tax. Thank you very much. We will be adjourned until tomorrow at 8 o'clock.
Tape 37, side 1. June 28, 1977, House Revenue Committee.
I'd like to start with Senate Bill 113. Don and Ira, are you folks going to take us through this bit of excitement?
I hope so.
No.
Mr. Chairman, Ira Jones, Assistant Attorney General with the Tax Division of the Department of Justice, here representing the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 113 was introduced at the request of the Department of Revenue to bring to the legislature's attention some of the problems that the department was going to be faced with classification of certain types of property. Already in other parts of the country, there is beginning to develop a controversy as to whether media constituting business records, computer software, files, records of accounts, title records, surveys, designs, credit references, and data contained therein is actually intangible personal property or whether it's tangible personal property. In other words, if it's intangible personal property, it's not taxable, and if it's tangible personal property, it is taxable. And so before we became mired in a multitude of lawsuits in trying to determine whether this is or is not, these items are or are not intangible personal property and therefore exempt from taxation, or whether it is tangible personal property subject to taxation, we felt that it would be better to bring this matter before the legislature and perhaps at least eliminate many lawsuits and therefore cut down on some of the litigation expense of the state of Oregon. Now, I might say that just reading through the list, it would look like that there's an awfully large amount of items that are covered, but yet when you start analyzing them, you find out that they are very similar in character. In other words, the media constituting business records, particularly now as we enter into the electronic age, is very similar to computer software. We find files or records of accounts are also electronic impulses that are on magnetic tape. So on title records are practically all now a matter of electronic impulses that are stored in computer tape. Business records, surveys, credit references and data, the whole thing are very similar in nature, and so we have submitted this list to you, feeling that looking at some of the court cases that have happened in other states while the taxing agencies have tried to contend that these are in fact tangible personal property. Many times the courts have gone the other way and said they're intangible personal property, but there are some other courts that have said no, that certain items are tangible property. This is just really kind of a mess right now is to try to determine which way the state should go, and that's the reason why we brought this bill to you. Now, while the bill was in the Senate, one question came up, and that is that the utilities had had several court cases in which some of these items had been classed by the courts as tangible property or as intangible property, depending on where its situs was going to be for purposes of taxation or whether it was even subject to tax or not. And they did not want, whatever we might do in including or not including some of these things, from upsetting those court cases. So that's the reason why subsection 4, starting on section 1, starting on lines 20 and 21 of page 2, have been added for their purposes. Then if you make that kind of provision in ORS 307.020, saying that the provisions of this section shall not apply to any person, company, corporation, or association covered by 308.505 to 308.665, the question comes then, has the Department of Revenue through all the years been following the proper procedure in appraising centrally assessed corporations? And to put down in statute what has been the policy from as near as I can find out, and Mr. Fisher, I think, will agree that the policy has been to not include in the valuation of such properties intangible property that represents claims on other property, including money at interest, bonds, notes, claims, demands, and all other evidence of indebtedness secured or unsecured, including notes, bonds, or certificates secured by mortgages, and all shares of stock in corporations, joint stock companies, or associations. And therefore, we wanted to put specifically in 308.510 that the property does not include these items. And so that is the change that is made in 308.510. So, okay, this bill really does then, I guess, about three things. One, it brings to you, and the Senate has decided that all of these items listed in lines, starting in line 9 through 12 on page 2, is and should be classified as intangible personal property. There is a provision in here that whatever the legislature does, it's not going to upset decisions that have been rendered by the courts in the past as to maybe the character of certain property for utility companies. And finally, 308.510 is amended to reflect what has been over the years the practice of the Department of Revenue in appraising utilities and other centrally assessed corporations.
Questions?
Ira, what I hear you saying is it's basically because of the growing value of some of these, even though they're difficult to personally assess, that the definition of intangibles needs to be extended to include all of these items. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we feel that they're all pretty much of the same type of thing, and we're finding that certainly in other states, and even within the state of Oregon, sometimes assessors are trying to go out and, or are thinking about anyway, going out and including some of these items as tangible personal property. And we frankly don't know whether they are or are not, and the court cases in other states really don't give us that much guidance.
How about a company that makes a business of selling off their computer tape list of addresses?
Well,
that would be inventory then.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Fish, Department of Revenue. That's typical of our problem. We think that the tape is tangible, but the knowledge and information on it is surely intangible. Just like when you have a computer software or a punch card, the most valuable part of the punch card is the hole that's in it. That's where the knowledge and information is. Now, if we were supposed to go out and assess all these kind of things, the magnetic impulses that are on tapes, that's not surely not tangible. But the media on which it is imposed, superimposed, that, of course, is tangible. And this is the problem that we get into. The courts have clearly held that software of a computer is intangible property. But over in the other extreme, they said that title plants is tangible property. Now, all this is just an assembling of data, pulling data together and putting it in some kind of form, whether it's in the form of magnetic impulses or holes, or even movie film. We've gotten into the movie film problem, where they say that the original movie is valuable, but the prints are not. So this example that we gave, 17 illustrations, that illustrate the problem, the scope of the thing. And what we're seeking, of course, is clarification. Once the legislature's pleasure.
Further questions or comments?
I apologize for not being here earlier, but the federal tax law now will be treating us differently. Or is it because of court cases that this is involved?
No, this is strictly property tax.
Oh, all right.
It would not affect the income tax statute.
Only if you're selling your... Only if you're selling your... the information.
That would be a capital gain and wouldn't affect the property tax aspect of it.
All we're doing here is broadening the definition to include these items.
Yeah.
That's right.
Further questions or comments? Is there a motion on Senate Bill?
I'd like to hear from BOI if we could at all before we move in.
Excuse me, Chuck, did you want
to? I'm terribly sorry, I didn't realize you wanted to testify.
I wasn't going to, but I'd be happy to comment. Chuck Williams, Associated Authority and Industries. This bill is a concern to us because as these things are becoming more transferred on the computer from just what would be normal procedures manuals set on a shelf, they have value, but they have value to one unit. They don't have value to another unit in the same business. Like a doctor's client file would be valuable to him, but it may not be as valuable to the next doctor that may take it or something, because you're going to have drop-off because people like X doctor, they don't like Y doctor. We see that if these things do start being encroached upon, it's just going to cause a myriad of court cases just building up on this thing. It probably costs the county assessor more work in trying to appraise it than he would actually get out of the documents if he has them. So this is a concern we have, Representative Kelly's. And we are very supportive of this bill because it clarifies a problem that we see coming up in the future.
I'm sorry, you are supportive of the
bill? We're supportive of the bill, yes, sir.
And your earlier comments indicate otherwise, and I was curious.
It's one of these inverted type of things. Voting yes is voting no. voting yes on the bill puts the items in the definition of intangible, and then in a separate statute, intangibles are said not to be taxable.
I haven't lost faith in any way yet. I was getting quite concerned for a minute there that I had read you
wrong. This is the problem. It's one of those inverted situations.
Mr. Klein? Representative Klein moves Senate Bill 113 to the public to pass recommendation. Amendments? Discussion? Quorum? Clerk, call the roll.
Gillis?
Aye.
Baldwin? Brunel?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Mark? Rigi?
Aye.
Van Vliet?
Aye.
Monroe?
Aye. Representative Mark? Representative Fabush?
Aye.
Blumenauer, aye.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Darling is here, I believe, representing Senator Hannon on 428. Welcome, John.
Clerk.
Welcome. Do you have something to tell us?
I don't really have anything to tell you. Yeah, this.
Representative Klein, you are a co-sponsor of this legislation. Do you want to comment to the committee?
I think that the memo distributed is self-explanatory. It provides front-end money that would otherwise require bonding supported by two senatorial authorities, including the one from my own area.
Is there any discussion?
Are we being consistent in the way we're treating this now? In other areas of authorities where we have, like, port authorities and things like that, and we're looking for front-end money in your assessments of any kind, 7% to 10%, did you check that out?
John, I think that this applies only to sanitary districts, doesn't it?
Sanitary
authorities.
Okay.
What? There are only two sanitary authorities in the state.
Yeah, right, only two of those. Any other kinds of things?
Didn't we get into this in intergovernmental affairs?
Yes, you did.
The difference between the difference between sanitary authorities and sanitary districts.
Right. And that part was amended out about the interest that you see in the title.
Has been amended?
It has been deleted.
Okay.
And Senate Bill 189, which I believe is up for a third reading in the House today, will completely obviate that whole bit of information. As I understand it, it allows only a 1% above cost of it.
Fine, thank you.
I'm fine.
Yes.
Can I ask
a
question? In your research on this, did you discover that this process is available to other special purpose districts? Irrigation, drainage.
I'm not sure about other districts. The manager of this said it was inadvertently left out of the law when sanitary authority law was written. But, as far as other districts, I don't know.
Chairman? Representative Fabush?
I don't want to get too much background on this, but...
Always a danger.
Does this give the sanitary authority the right to assess for a facility without any kind of a vote or authorization?
Oh, no.
It allows them to assess affected areas before construction. So, they run sewer pipe out to remote areas.
What would be the process? I mean, would there be a local election for the either being included within the authority, or how does it, or is this just an authority out there building sewers as they want and taxing people before they get there?
No, it has to be requested and asked for. No, that's how it works.
You folks amended the interest out.
Unless they're in there.
It's in a different bill.
Unless they're in the district.
What I'm worried about here is the...
Just associate themselves with the district.
Partly this is...
Yeah.
Partly we've got districts in the intergovernmental affairs amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Just a second. Representative Ricky, you want to comment on the history. You've seen it before.
Well, it was in intergovernmental affairs. Where we were working on partly the interest question, and the interest question is in a different bill that's going to be on the floor today from some source.
189.
But the process, we were determining the difference in status of a sanitary district and a sanitary authority. And whatever other decisions you want to make, this was intended to apply to sanitary authorities, not to districts in its original intent. The House amendment made over in our committee says this, and I'm...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
The summary still says district.
The summary still says district. If you look at the top of page 2 on the bill, Senate bill,
it says authority. And so the only amendment we made was in regard to an intergovernmental affairs and deleting of two lines. I don't have the original bill. I
just... Body of the bill of this authority. Now, what kind of a logical amendment is that? Do you folks from the Department of Revenue have any comment on this bill?
I don't think it makes any sense out of eliminating line 30 because it's only part of a sentence and it leaves out only one word.
All the way up to 5288.
Oh, we just need to correct the amendment. Oh, I see. All right.
He's in. Len is in. Always needs.
The directors have been carrying this bill step by step, and I haven't been following it that closely, so I regret I don't have a lot of information, but they're tired of making a 250-mile trip, and this came as kind of a surprise.
How many previous committees has the bill been before, John, in the Senate and the House now?
There's one in the Senate, and this is the second in the House.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill before you pass recommendation.
Representative Klein moves Senate Bill 428 to approve the do-pass recommendation. Okay, do we want, in fact, have we determined whether or not, in fact, we want to correct any language?
No summary, but that can be taped out.
Regardless of the summary, that...
Chairman, I think one of our legal types may well wonder what we're saying in line 34 with the word sound discretion.
Oh, I had no problem with that. That's like reasonable attorney's fees.
Whatever they can get away with.
Ira, Ted, do you folks have any comment to make
legal
about the bill? No.
Should use prudent man.
We're using a policy of sound wisdom, sound silence.
I see. The motion is to the floor do pass. Representative Monroe?
To get at the point that Representative Fawbush was making, in my reading of this bill, and I think in its intent, the Sanitary Authority Board can, in fact, in its sound discretion.
Levy estimate
against, yeah, estimates against the property. That's right. Without a vote, I don't see any provision in here for a vote. So I think that you're perfectly right. That is the purpose of it, to give them that authority to raise that front money by estimating what the cost will be in their sound discretion, and by making levies on the properties affected. That's my reading of the bill. If anybody else reads it differently, I'd like to hear it.
That's what
the bill does.
But before sanitary authority is created, there's got to be a vote to authorize the creation of it. Doesn't there have to be a bonding, or not a bonding election, but at least an election to authorize the expenditures of a given amount of money to the...
Well, that's my whole question.
And that... correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't there have to be some sort of authorization for at least the expenditure of the funds, even if not an authorization for
Richard Shaking
bond?
Head.
Yeah.
But I was here, and he probably,
I don't know,
with the local budget law, as knowledgeable as anybody, and going over all the budgets in the state, and really ought to
drink.
Like an IRA, and to John. I think there has to be an election. I was
the creation of the board.
The creation of the district.
And then after that.
And the board members are elected. But I think unless they bond, or unless they put out a property tax levy for a vote of the people, that there would not have to be a further election. If they have a balanced budget with the resources they have and are doing that through assessment that is not requiring an election, then there would be no election on any part of their budget. And this process, I would presume, would allow a district to incrementally finance
an authority, not a district.
In other words, well, it's the developer's dream.
Right now, yeah. Right now, then, someone could sit down and, well, this board could sit down and say, we're going to put a sewer line through down East Street, and there are 100 properties down East Street that's going to cost us $100,000, and the properties benefit roughly equally, and we'll use this procedure, and it's going to charge each property owner $1,000. Is that right?
I'm not sure, really.
You're not sure?
No.
That would be pretty.
That sounds.
John, that's my reading of the bill.
Would you like to go on to another bill?
I'm not going
to
support this until I hear something different.
Representative Klein, would you like to temporarily withdraw your motion?
We can hold the motion in advance.
Let's move to Senate Bill 447. This is legislation I talked to Senator Tia yesterday. He is interested in seeing us take action to clarify the status of homeowner associations. This is not unlike what we have with the condominium, how the owners organize themselves. My understanding is that this conforms to how federal government treats these associations for tax purposes.
Yes.
Richard, do you want to comment?
What this really you have may be a development, and in the development, the owners are contributing maybe, let's say, $100 a month to a homeowner association, and the association then turns around and re-roofs your house once every 10 years and paints your house once every 5 years and takes care of the maintenance and effect of the property. If you do that yourself, by contributing to the homeowner association, the homeowner association will be able to go ahead and be treated as a corporation and be taxed as a corporation in the state under the federal law, just like the federal law would treat that association. The problem comes if they build up any reserve, and then the individual under current law is going to be, because of the reserve, any interest earned on the reserve, the person would be charged, or will have to include that in his own income, filling out his own return. So this allows that association to go ahead and do the maintenance and repair on the buildings through a monthly charge process, and allow the corporation then to be treated and taxed as a corporation, even though it might not be incorporated. We have a lot of varied treatment of that now, just because of maybe people being ignorant of the law. A few people in a neighborhood getting together and forming some kind of an association for maintenance, and then not being aware of the potential taxability of what they're doing.
Interesting. If I paint my house, I don't get a break at all in the money I spend on it, do I?
Well,
no break on it, no. And if you pay it to a corporation that does it, you don't get any break on it either. But if the corporation invests it for a period of time, depending on the lumpiness of their expenditures, you might be involved in interest.
Big deal. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Fabush moves that we table Senate Bill 447. Not debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Healy?
Yes.
No.
Fabush?
Aye.
Grinnell?
Chairman?
No.
Klein?
No.
Mark?
No.
Rieke?
No.
Endley?
No.
Monroe?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
No. Ira or Ted, did you? I'm your gentleman.
On Senate Bill 447.
Yes, right. Here we are.
Excuse me, I was busy studying the problem with the previous bill. Senate Bill 447, Mr. Chairman, may be a useful tool in that what this does is conform the state law with the federal law as a result of a change in federal law brought about by the Tax Reform Act of 1976. There's always been a problem with some of these homeowners associations, either they're in the form of condominiums or some other type of association. Some of them are corporations, some of them...
Excuse me. I think Richard basically outlined that while you
okay,
were...
Okay, well, I was going to say that this does conform so that the state law will be the same as the federal and will allow these things to be taxed as corporations and has all the safeguards that the federal law does have.
Can you tell me what income they're likely to have that might be taxable, and only income on investment if it was invested?
Probably income on investment, or I would think if they had income on some other sales that's not related to the upkeep, something like that.
Are they required to keep any kind of reserves at all, Ira, under federal law?
No. Not necessarily, because this is just sort of almost a cooperative type of thing, and sort of to make these owners that they can pay these things ratably through their monthly fees, or to take care of the maintenance and so on, same as you and I would use in taking care of our own maintenance of our houses. Only we don't put it away monthly. We usually wait till the crunch comes and then we dig up the money. This is that the association can't do this, and so they put it away gradually. And as that is accumulated, that is not income. Yeah, under present law, it could very easily be income and would be income. But under this bill, it would not.
You're saying that the investment that people are making, following up on what Tony was talking about earlier, for the maintenance of the grounds, the repair of the roof, without benefit of legislation like this, might be subject to taxation.
Might be subject to income tax, yes. And that's part of the problem.
Excuse me, Bob. I just wanted to clarify that in my own mind.
Yeah. The co-op under Oregon law is non-taxable, right? It's a corporate tax on the basis. Taxes on the distribution of the proceeds to the
cooperative
owners, is that right?
A true co-op does not pay taxes on the amounts of profits that are distributed back to its owners.
Right. Oh, but anything it retains, it does.
But if it retains over a certain amount, yes, it does. But this is, I shouldn't have used the word cooperative. I wasn't thinking in terms of a cooperative organization. I'm thinking of a
loose association. More resemble those, though, doesn't it? Is there a reason why these entities should be treated differently than those, except for the fact of bookkeeping?
Well,
co-ops
are already treated a certain way under the tax laws. This is kind of a different type of organization that is very loosely formed. Some of them are corporations, some of them are just loose associations, and what this bill does is treat them all the same way. And really, a co-op doesn't come under this because
it's
better.
The amount of income would be taxable for anyway.
What's the name of the big development up by Ben? Sun River? Sun River, the people buy those units in the condominium. They're owned by people.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody locks up their stuff or puts it in the locker or something. And those are rented. Those are rented to people when they aren't used by the condominium owner.
Okay.
Now, what do you do?
That rental will still be taxed. This bill will not change
okay.
that.
Okay. I just want to be sure.
In under 3, under D, I'm sorry, you've got this one part that you ought to be sure you're aware of, that no part of the net earnings of the organization is going to go to the benefit of the shareholder individuals. So you can't have the organization collecting money and then distributing it back out in some way. Collecting from some and distributing back out.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
I think we've had a couple of hearings on this, at least one before this, and I feel comfortable moving it to the floor if we pass recommendation.
Representative Klein moves Senate Bill 447 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Questions? Clerk will call the roll.
McKillop?
Aye.
Walbush?
No.
Brunel?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Mark?
Aye.
Ricci?
Aye.
Van Vliet?
Aye.
Monroe?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Thank you, Adam. Senator Hanlon. We were in the throes of wrestling with Senate Bill 428, and the committee, I think, would like to have explained the mechanics. I believe that's where we left in terms of, I can't remember who was raising the question. Representative Fabush, you're in the ones in the contrary mood this morning, asking the nasty questions. Do you want to restate?
Lynn, what's the procedure for authorization for either expansion of facilities? What kind of approval within the district or within the authority by the people affected? What kind of approval do they have to give, or do they get the chance to voice an opinion as to whether or not they want a facility built before it's set?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, now, as I understand it, and I might be corrected in this, but there's only two sanitary authorities in the state. There's Tillamook and this one, and they were created in, the one in Southern Oregon was created in the 50s, and don't ask me why it was created as statutorily as authority versus a special district, but they have the same statutes that reflect creation, power to annex, power to deliver service as a special district. So it'd go to the vote of the people, it'd be referred to those people affected in that direct area. They're restricted by what areas they can develop in, by land use funding goals, county urban growth boundaries, city urban growth boundaries, so there are statutes and a whole wide range that we could get into on this.
So what this bill would essentially do then, if I'm correct, is once they have that kind of approval, it would allow them to assess that rather than to bond.
What they're asking for is that there was two bills, it was Senate Bill 427 and Senate Bill 428. They wanted the statutes to be changed so that they would be included. There were two statutory references that were contained in 427, and one was in 428, that special districts have, that the sanitary authorities did not have. They just wanted to change the statute so that all reflect the same change.
They've actually got to go to the people to get approval of a specific amount for expenditures, even if they have this pre-assessed procedure. They can't just say, we want to go down E Street and there's 100 properties down E Street.
And assess those people, they can't do that.
They can't do that.
No.
That was our...
Mr. Chairman?
I have another question. Senator Hammett, this question wasn't answered when this was over in intergovernment, as I remember, and this had to do with the fact that you're working on an estimate rather than on a known cost. For assessments. In that case, there is the possibility, because the bill speaks to making supplementary assessments and rebates, of being in debt, which under Oregon Constitution you can't. Was that question addressed, do you remember, in the Senate? Bill didn't spend very long in the intergovernment committee in the House.
Mr. Chairman, if memory serves me correct, the attorney, Manville Heisel, for the sanitary authority, did address that issue. And if I remember right, the issue was raised on what was the need of having that language in there. And if they put out a bid, and that bid assumes so much, and then there are adjusted changes in construction as that project goes along, this gives the sanitary authority the power to amend, cut back, reduce, give the rebates back to the people under assessment. But they have to project something out there to present to the voters for them to vote on. If the project does not come up to that cost, then they can refund the amount that the people did approve on a ballot. Now, I could be wrong. Someone from legal experience might have some better background on this, but it's my understanding that they have to put an assessment figure out there for the people to vote on the bond issue. If the project does not come up to that cost, say it is under that amount of money that the people approved, and it gives them the ability, if the project does not go that much, to rebate what the true actual cost is.
It also apparently gives them the power, if it costs more than that, to make a supplementary assessment.
If I remember right, Mr. Chairman, I don't feel that question was asked in the Intergovernmental Relations Committee. It was not asked of Mr. Heisel, and I don't think it was addressed, and I couldn't tell you. I could find out and get back to you on that.
I hate to delay it at this point, but I...
Perhaps
one of our own attorneys.
Perhaps Mr. Jones might outline the procedure.
Which question in relation to the question that Representative Rieke has asked, if you're going to refund the cost or the excess estimated assessment down to what it actually costs, there's probably going to be some other areas where the cost may be more. And this is not uncommon. I remember when, of course, it wasn't a sanitary authority, but I remember when the sewers were put in South Salem, there was one area where the cost almost doubled what anybody anticipated, and that was that they got so far under the surface and they found out they ran into a series of great big boulders, probably as big as this table. They either had to cut through or dig out or something like that. That became a very expensive process, but somewhere along the line, in all the testing that had been done, that hadn't been found out. And then there were some other areas where they anticipated rock and something like that, and instead of that, they could go along. They didn't even have to shore up the ditches or anything else and put the sewer through, and of course the cost is much less. So I would think that if you're going to make this project work, you're going to have both ways. You're going to have to refund those people where the costs are less, and there may be times when you're going to have to actually increase the assessment because the project just is going to cost more because of some kind of a condition that people didn't anticipate. You can have such things as land not being able to retain itself, so you got to shore up along the way. It's got to go either way.
Okay, but if you'd been given authority by the people to issue bonds, which they have to vote on, and you were going to do it the bonding route, and you ran into those boulders, you needed more money, you'd have to go back and get authority, wouldn't you? You'd have to go back and get authority from people to issue more bonds, get through.
Well, bonds. Either that, or you're going to have to raise the money some way. Yes.
Now, in this, would you have to go back to the people for a vote to increase that assessment?
I wouldn't think so. Not on this. Let me go through the procedure that the statute set up for starting a project. I think. And that is that the statutes provide for a hearing on the board's proposal, which the construction plans and estimated special assessments and so on are all put out. There is a hearing that is provided. The board has to give notice and so on of this hearing. It may continue the hearings if need be, and it can also change the estimates, also maybe the boundaries and so on, and the area of property that's going to be assessed as a result of these hearings. Then after the hearings are concluded and the board has its information and believes that it really has a handle on what the costs are, then it has to adopt an ordinance specifying the action of the board and what it finally determined, which will set forth the installations, the proposed estimated cost of the assessments, and so on. And this ordinance has to be published once a week for two successive weeks in a newspaper of general circulation. And within 30 days after the last publication, people have a period in which to remonstrance against the ordinance. And if the majority of the people, in other words, if remonstrances are filed by a majority of the owners of the land, then it goes to a vote. If there aren't that many people that remonstrance against it, then the board can proceed and the election doesn't have to take place. So there is ample authority for due process and so on. The statute does then provide that the way that this is going to be funded, of course, is through the assessment method on a benefited basis. Now, what this bill does, as I understand it, is permit the board, I would assume after the ordinance finally comes into fruition, to go out and start collecting ahead of time on an estimated basis from the property owner so that it can have money to go ahead and operate and let contracts and do all the rest of the things that are necessary, subject to the adjustment after the project is completed.
Isn't that covered in lines 16 and 17 on page 3? Well, that entire section.
Right, that would...
Supplementary assessments and rebates.
That is the part of the bill that does permit the adjustments to take place. Because I think it is seldom, if ever, do the estimates come out right directly with the cost.
I'm just answering the question of acquiring a debt and making a supplementary assessment. Make supplementary assessment before you acquire the debt.
Well, here, if you could make the... I guess
you have to balance your budget is all I'm saying, aren't I?
Mary, all assessments made pursuant to subsection 3 of ORS whatever shall be determined and made by an order of the board, adopted in accordance with such procedures as shall be established by a general ordinance adopted by the board. Such general ordinance then shall...
So if in that general...
If we stayed in the hall long enough, this bill would be out of committee,
well,
or table.
I think I've heard enough, Mr. Chairman. I would move it to the floor.
There isn't any constitutional inhibition for this procedure from being followed.
Representative Marks has moved Senate Bill 447 to the floor with the Dukas recommendation. Further discussion, Representative Monroe.
I have one more very important question. Would this bill put sanitary authorities, both of them, on exactly the same footing as sanitary districts? Or would it give them further discretion? In other words, this bill has been brought to us as, you know, the main purpose being to put sanitary authorities on the same level with sanitary districts, give them the same powers. Does it do that, or does it give them additional powers that sanitary districts don't have? And if so, how can we justify that?
Well,
it seems to me that we should have an answer to that question before we move on this bill.
Well, I'm willing in this area to act in whatever, by whatever means the committee feels most comfortable. If the majority wants to go on 428, that's fine. It's my intention not to have another committee meeting unless there is additional legislation that's assigned to us for action.
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 428 to the floor with a due pass.
We have a pending motion. The question has been called for. Representative Monroe.
I will not support the motion until I get an answer to my question.
The question...
Sorry, I think it's a big, important question.
The question I guess I would put to you, Representative Monroe, is if you would be willing to allow the rest of the committee to vote...
Certainly.
...before you have an answer to your question, reserving the right to fight it vigorously on the floor if you find that there... Would that be a reasonable approach to take?
Fine.
The clerk will call the roll on sending Senate Bill 428 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Kelly.
Aye.
Bobbish.
Aye.
Grinnell.
Aye.
Klein.
Aye.
Mark.
Aye.
Reiki.
Aye.
Van Vliet.
Aye.
Monroe.
No.
Chairman.
No.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to have a response for...
I think that would be helpful. I would also like a copy of it, Senator. The last bill, hopefully, that we'll have to hear is Senate Bill 921. It's in your book. Richard might briefly describe for us what the bill is and does.
The bill really just defines extended for purposes of footpaths and bike paths. Apparently, the Department of Transportation is having some problems with meeting their statutory requirement for money spent on footpaths and bike trails, and being able to precisely determine the amount that's needed when you come up to the end of a fiscal year, and you might have contracts out and knowing specifically how much it's going to be expended before you write the checks. So they would like to broaden or define the word expended as they do on page 2, starting on line 22.
What this does, in effect, I think, is to allow them to count as meeting their requirement of putting in the 1%, even if they haven't expended the money.
That's right. Let the contract, but haven't written the check.
So that they might defer their obligation over time.
They could be pushing more and more to the end of the year.
Does it allow double counting? In other words, if
it may not even allow single counting. I think it's an interesting bill. I think it ought to be referred to Ways and Means as an issue that they can take up as they work on our bike path, part of the highway package. I feel very, very uncomfortable acting on the bill, and I think it's more appropriately done down there when we deal with the definitions.
Those are the Ways and Means.
If there's no objection, I won't do anything with it, and we'll just call it to the attention of the folks from Ways and Means. I will hand deliver this very day a copy of this bill to Senator Ripper and or Dwayne Wolf and let them do with it what they will. They're looking at the same area of the statute. If there's no objection, I would like to adjourn the committee. We will not meet unless there is additional legislation.
That's all right.
I think we
get the tire and feathers ready.
No. Yeah, I know. The veterans bill. Are we going to get that after?
If it's assigned to our committee.
No. 3112, the homestead exemption increase.
We
75 to 15.
It's my understanding that we stopped dealing with House bills last Thursday.
Well, we can move that into a Senate bill, Mr. Chairman. What's the pleasure of the committee? If there isn't 5 votes here, then let's not do it. Otherwise, but I feel like, I have an obligation to bring it up because several people have asked.
Got my vote.
I will do what the committee's pleasure is. It's my intention that we're through with.
Say that, why don't we look for a Senate bill now?
I don't think we have. Well, let's just take the bill. We haven't. If that's the will of the committee, let's just take the bill. I don't think we have any. I have any problems. I'm sure the sponsor of the bill would much rather have his bill move. What's the committee's pleasure?
Move.
Is that the consensus of the majority of the committee?
To
move on Senate bill. House Bill 3112.
Is that the number? That's the correct number.
General number.
Sure. Get the bill out.
75 to 1500, isn't it? Or 15,000. Is that what it is?
There will be a shift. There'll be two shifts.
Whatever property is left on the roll.
After we've executed everything else. Pretty soon, Mr. Chairman, there'll be no more shifts.
For disabled veterans, but it defines disabled down to only 30% disabled and above or something like
what
that.
What was it before?
That's current language, I believe.
Yeah, it's current language, but it doubles their exemption.
Ira or Ted, you folks want to join us? For the benefit of the committee, you might explain how the current program works, how serious any veteran over 65 is disabled.
Is that correct? For purposes of this statute?
There are two classes of veterans, correct or wrong. There's one who has to get a certificate of disability from the federal government, the military, and armed forces. And once he gets that wise, then that qualifies him for the exemption. There's the other class who cannot get a certificate of disability and who can get but can be qualified as disabled by, I believe it's a local physician.
Local physician or yeah. County health officer.
But he also has to meet an income test.
$2,500 receipt.
Yeah. More than $2,500 total gross income during the last calendar year.
If he receives more than that, he's not eligible for the exemption.
So you might have a veteran who has a disability from some other source than service incurred who has to meet this much tougher test of income. I don't know why they don't change that if you have a problem too. But
I'm sorry, Ted.
Well, I'm just thinking about inflation. That's been in there for a long time, $2,500. But anyway, there are two classes, as you see. And I assume that the guts of the bill is simply to recognize inflation with respect to the amount of the exemption. That's all it does, is raise it from $7,500 to
$1,500.
$15,000.
And this also applies to the widow remaining unmarried of a veteran without any regard to income. She also gets this exemption.
Anybody on the committee who's a veteran and married is negligent if they don't have on their bulletin board at home something to call the attention of the widow to the fact that if the veteran dies, the widow is entitled to exemption regardless of whether the veteran was entitled to it. Now, this is something that we find all the time. You know, widows fail to file. That should be on everybody's bulletin board. Or in your will or something.
When I die, I apply.
But, this $7,500 has been in the law for an awful long time. So I don't know how many years, but 20
years?
20
years.
Yes, it's been there at least 20 years.
Yeah, as long as I can recall. Maybe in 1949 it was $3,500, something like that. But all I can remember is $7,500. And I think there is, you don't want any comments from me about the merits of the bill, but.
Oh, wouldn't bother me. But that's neither here nor there.
Depends on which side you're on.
Of course, I think this should be raised.
This is a
bill. What is the fiscal impact of?
It just narrows the tax base.
Yes, I want to know. I want to know the shift, and I want to.
Oh, how many are getting this?
Yes, you told me.
A whole bunch was the answer. I remember you gave me 5 minutes.
A whole bunch.
How do you guys feel about moving the group?
What do we do? If we pass 3112, what are we doing on folks that are left in the event that there are any still in the world? Except for
we have about 29,000 veterans that currently have the exemption resulting in about a $215 million exemption off the roll.
So double that.
And yes.
Well, and we're finding out that any widow qualifies. How many widows are we talking about, even if there aren't? If full advantage were taken of this bill, what are we talking about in terms of a shift?
Your status, widow to remain unmarried, and you realize that is a handicap to which keeps the number down.
$250 million.
Oh, that's right.
That's the value.
If you're watching 60 minutes, your
dollars should be about.
It's about double that.
You don't get married anymore.
$10 million.
About $10 million.
$11.1 million we have down.
There's that much.
And what's the HARP savings? Million?
Yeah, you'll
well, a significant number of the people that are actually getting benefit of the exemption are in higher income in the HARP category, at least when we did tabulation on it before. You have Supreme Court justices that get veterans exemption now. You have a variety of people that are eligible for it.
Careful, you're getting close to violating the secrecy provision.
No, that's not. That's an application that goes to the assessors. That's not.
Oh, I'm public record.
It is public record.
But so those people aren't affected at all. You don't get any reduction in the HARP program due to them, because the only way you're going to get a reduction in the HARP program is if you're the combination of the HARP program and this exemption wipes out all their taxes.
Wouldn't that be the case for a significant number of folks?
Well, the lower income ones, it will be. But the again, you have an awful lot of veterans that benefit from the program that aren't lower income.
That's because we've given them so many benefits over the years.
And they have 10 extra preference points.
Yeah, I have one question.
I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Monroe.
In order to get classified by the federal government as a disabled veteran, does the disability have to be military related?
Yes.
To get the, under the first part.
Well, to get the certificate from the armed forces,
for the
yes.
40%.
To be able to certify by your.
But under the second part.
No, but that, in order to meet under the second part there, you've got to meet the $2,500.
Right.
So that's going to eliminate virtually everybody.
Plus, we didn't mention that the people in the Spanish-American War, Philippine Insurrection,
Rebellion,
don't have to meet any yeah. of those qualifications.
They probably meet all of them.
Yeah, there's a few of them that are making more than $2,500 a year.
Yeah, there's a couple.
Four or five
that's still alive in Oregon.
How many?
Four or five
of them. We wouldn't want them to be
honored before about 1880.
Call for the question on the motion.
Yeah, the question's been called for. There being no further discussion, I guess the clerk will call the roll.
Kelly?
No.
Bobush?
Aye.
Grinnell?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Mark?
Aye.
Ricci?
No.
Van Vliet?
No.
Monroe?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
There were no failed veterans.
Thank you very much.
Chairman, before we adjourn,
we just did.
Chairman, I just make one quick comment of appreciation to Richard Munt and his staff.
Really, very appreciative of me, Richard,
and all the patience and tolerance that I've been with you much longer. And patience and tolerance on the other.
You brought us a long way.
How did I get a bill laid on the period on the very day that I had the period?
Are you paying for
this? Yes, that's why.